of abundance over them. And God is able to bless you abundantly, so that in all things at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. 2 Corinthians 9:8. I asked him to help others succeed. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Philippians 2:4. I asked him to send more people, not less, into ministry. We are all on the same team. Therefore, I promised him I would give them my knowledge and contacts. This is what Jesus reminds us. The harvest is great, but the workers are few. So pray to the Lord who is in charge of the harvest. Ask him to send more workers into his fields. Luke 10:2. I knew I was finally getting somewhere when I could authentically say, her success does not threaten mine. It's so true, sweet friend. When she does well, we all do well. All tides rise when we see a sister making this world a better place with her gifts. When I started believing this, my scarcity thinking started turning into abundance. And that was 18 published books ago. So even as the closed doors and rejections seem more prevalent than the new opportunities you'd like to see, even as you're seeking to readjust your thinking, remember that there is an abundant need in this world for your contributions to the kingdom, your thoughts and words and artistic expressions, your exact brand of beautiful. Choose to live loved while you're in the middle of the journey, and know that what he has in mind for you is so much more than you imagine. Chapter 11. 10 Things You Must Remember When Rejected. I scooted into the restaurant booth beside my daughter Ashley. We ordered guacamole, extra ice for my unsweetened tea, and extra lemons for her water. She pulled out her phone and nervously tapped a few keys, then shoved it back in her purse. I don't want to look yet. Her first semester college grades had been posted for 2 days, but she'd refused to look at them. We decided to do it together at one of our favorite restaurants. Together is a great way to press through something you're afraid could make you feel a bit undone. She'd worked so hard. Her schedule had been incredibly challenging, and there had been several sleepless nights when she wasn't sure she could push through. After all, school hadn't always been easy for Ashley. When she was in the 8th grade, her teachers requested a meeting with Art and me. We were stunned to find out that 2 months into the school year, she was failing every class. It wasn't from her lack of effort. She'd turned in her assignments and she'd studied for the test. But she simply wasn't grasping the new curriculum her school had switched to that year. Her averages were so low that even if she started making A's from that point on, things really couldn't be turned around. Their only suggestion was to have her go back and repeat 7th grade. Immediately, I knew that would never work. The school was a very small private school where it'd be really difficult to make a switch like this without hard questions, assumptions, and opinions. Middle school is not the time to proclaim to all your peers, I can't cut it in the 8th grade, so basically I'm going to hang with the 7th graders for the rest of the year. I also think the school knew this wouldn't work. They offered to help us have her transferred to a different school. It wasn't intended as a rejection, but it sure felt like one. Sometimes what seems like a practical solution on one side can feel like a complete dissolution on the other. This private school that had once felt so right and so safe was now very much a closed door for our daughter. We had no choice but to transfer her to a public school where the kids would be oblivious to the fact that Ashley was repeating the 7th grade. Her confidence was rocked. Her plans felt shaky, and her academic future seemed scary. But 2 weeks into her fresh start at the new school, her English teacher presented her with an award for a poem she'd written in class. This one boost of encouragement lit a spark in Ashley. Slowly, little successes at her new school gave her enough confidence to believe it was possible to turn things around. And by the end of that year, she was on the dean's list. By the time she got into high school, she was making great grades and even graduated with honors. Now in college, she'd chosen an academically rigorous major. The freshman classes for that difficult major are known for weeding out many of the students. She's very aware of how challenging this would be. She'd given it her all. But the exams all carried a lot of weight towards her overall grades, and she just wasn't sure how she'd done. Now it was time to look at the results. I coaxed her to pull the phone back out and open the email. Though that eighth grade rejection was very far from her at that point, somehow the lingering fear from that past experience was as present at that lunch as the guacamole. This fear's ability to control her emotions was painfully obvious. The enemy loves to take our rejection and twist it into a raw, irrational fear that God really doesn't have a good plan for us. This fear is a corrupting companion. It replaces the truth we've trusted with hopeless lies. Satan knows what consumes us, controls us. Therefore, the more consumed we are with rejection, the more he can control our emotions, our thinking, and our actions. That's the exact place where panic starts to replace peace. Uncertainty starts to overshadow our faith, and discouragement threatens to override our joy. What does a broken-hearted person do? We must praise God, seek God, look to God, call to God, experience God, fear God, learn from God, honor God, draw near to God, and take refuge in God. This is how we take back control from something or someone that was never meant to have it, and declare God as Lord. To help us see how we can practice this when the worries of rejection try to control us, here are 10 things to remember and proclaim. 1. One rejection is not a projection of future failures. It's good to acknowledge the hurt, but don't see it as a permanent hindrance. Move on from the source of the rejection, and don't let it shut you down in that arena of life. It has already stolen enough from your present. Don't let it reach into your future. No, that relationship didn't work out, but that doesn't mean you'll never find love. It also doesn't mean you aren't capable, likable, and lovely. No, your book proposal wasn't a good fit for that publisher, but that doesn't mean you can't write. You don't have to have a published book to be an effective writer. No, you didn't get that job opportunity, but that doesn't mean there won't be other interested companies. No, Ashley didn't thrive at one school, but that didn't mean she couldn't thrive at another school. Replace the negative talk that will hinder you. Replace it with praises for God, who will deliver you. I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. I will glory in the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. Psalm 34:1-4. 2. Rejection doesn't label you. It enables you to adjust and move on. It's our choice to have either a realistic view or a pessimistic view of rejection. People with a realistic view see rejection as a natural part of life and adjust accordingly. It's not that they don't struggle through the hard feelings, they do. But they don't let them cloud their whole view of life. They are still able to see plenty of positive in themselves, others, and in God's plan. Those with a pessimistic view, on the other hand, see life through the lens of their rejection. They feed their outlook by putting negative labels on themselves. When you feed negativity on the inside, it's negativity that you'll exude on the outside. This only compounds the hurt. Pessimists don't want to stay stuck in this downward spiral, but they feel swallowed up by the emotional shame of rejection. You can only stop the spiral by replacing the labels. Fill in the blank. This rejection doesn't mean I'm whatever negative label or shamed-filled feeling you are having. It makes this opportunity, person, desire a wrong fit for me right now. Instead of letting the feelings from this situation label me, I'm going to focus on God and his promises for good things. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. Psalm 34:5. 3. This could be an invitation to live in expectation of something else. Good things are coming. I know it. Today's disappointment is making room for tomorrow's appointment. Let's look for good things with great intentionality. I was reminded to do this by a friend I recently invited to go on a trip. She was thrilled and very much wanted to go, but as she prayed about it, she felt the Lord was telling her not to accept the invitation. She was confused because she couldn't see one reason why this wasn't a good idea. But to be obedient to God, she texted me she would not be able to make the trip work. I read her text and felt so bummed. I wondered if her decline was for financial reasons or something else I could help her overcome. I picked up the phone and called her. She explained there weren't any specific reasons. She simply knew deep in her heart that God was saying this wasn't the way she was supposed to fill her schedule during that time period. Instead, she was to circle those days on her calendar and then watch with trust and expectation for God to reveal other plans. I was so inspired by my friend's response. I want to live in expectation of God's invitation. Therefore, like my friend, I need to get better about looking for, recording, and focusing on these God appointments in the midst of disappointments. Believing God has purposed our days will save us from the trouble of stepping into plans that aren't meant for us. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him, to the one who seeks him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Lamentations 3:24-26. 4. There is usually some element of protection wrapped in every rejection. This is a hard one to process at the time of the rejection. But for many of my past rejections, I can look back and see how God was allowing things to unfold the way they did for my protection. In his mercy, he allowed this. It was a mercy ruin. It's easy for us to focus on the ruin, but look for his mercy in the midst of it. In the mercy, we'll find the protection. In the mercy, you can see things falling into place rather than falling apart. I see this in what appeared to be the ruin of Ashley needing to switch schools. I'm not sure we would have made such a move had the school not forced our hand. Our other kids were thriving there and needed to stay. Having Ashley at a different school added some complexities we wouldn't have wanted to take on, but we had no other choice. I didn't realize how much Ashley needed this change, but the Lord certainly knew what he was doing when he allowed all this to unfold. All the wonderful tenacity tucked inside Ashley was being slowly stripped out of her in an environment where she felt she could never get ahead. Switching to a different school gave her a chance to start over. When I see her thriving now, I see the protection in this. I no longer think of that other school in terms of holding Ashley back. I now see they helped us set her free. This helps me trust God's protection in other rejection situations where I can't see it. Maybe you are in one of those situations right now. When that wonderful, godly man walks away, where's the protection in that? When that opportunity didn't come through that would have helped so much financially, where's the protection in that? When several close friends go on a girl's weekend and neglect to include you, where's the protection in that? Into that space of not understanding, we simply must state, God, I don't understand this situation, but I do understand your goodness to me. I thank you for the protection that is part of this rejection, even when I can't see it. I trust you. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his holy people, for those who fear him lack nothing. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Psalm 34:7-10. 5. It's good to ask the what questions, but less helpful to ask why. Decide you'll only ask questions that help you move forward instead of feeling stuck in the reason something happened. What questions increase our ability to become more self-aware, while why questions only focus on things out of our control, Pride loves to whisper, it's their issue, not yours. Insecurity loves to whisper, you are a mess. You are the issue. But what a tragedy it would be to suffer this hurt and refuse the precious and costly gifts of humility and maturity this situation could very well give you. Questions I found helpful. What is one good thing I've learned from this? What was a downside to this situation that I could be thankful is no longer my burden to carry? What were the unrealistic expectations I had? And how can I better manage these next time? What do I need to do to boost my courage to pursue future opportunities? What is one positive change I could make in my attitude about the future? What are some lingering negative feelings about this situation that I need to pray through and shake off to be better prepared to move forward? What is one thing God has been asking me to do today to make tomorrow easier? I've also found it helpful to write these things down and get some solid friends around you to help you think through these questions. Chances are they can help you see things you'll miss on your own. The Lord is wooing us to listen and learn these lessons that will help us look more and more like Him. Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Psalm 34:11. 6. Don't hash, bash, or trash on the internet. Remember, the internet never forgets. It's good to have a trusted and wise friend to process rejection with. She will be able to let your emotions work themselves out without forever labeling you as irrational. The World Wide Web and social media, on the other hand, won't be so forgiving. Wisdom makes decisions today that will still be good for tomorrow. Don't let today's reaction become tomorrow's regret. Even using the seemingly innocent emoji that hints at broken hearts, crying rivers of tears, and stunned confusion will only invite the public into your very private need to heal. If you feel you need more intensive help, find a Christian counselor to meet with. It doesn't mean you are unhealthy or unstable if you see a counselor. Actually, some of the most well-adjusted people I know attribute their healthy ways of processing emotions to the counselors they've seen throughout the years. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from telling lies. Psalm 34:12-13. 7. There's much more to you than the part that was rejected. One of the hard parts of rejection is the time gap it suddenly introduces into your life. Chances are you're used to a routine that included set-aside time for the person or opportunity that rejection has taken from you. Now that the pursuit has ended, it's so easy to feel completely lost. Use this extra time to discover new things about yourself. That's how I discovered my passion for writing. I tried and failed at several creative pursuits when I first quit my full-time job to stay home with the kids. And when I say failed, we're talking about went down in flames. The list included floral designer. I was allergic to something in the shop, and my constant struggle with this annoyed the shop owner to no end. Eventually, she said she wanted to free me to pursue other endeavors, aka, you're fired. Wedding planner. I threw up at the very first wedding I helped plan. And not quietly in the bathroom by myself. Nope. I'll just let your imagination fill in the gaps from here. Mural painter. It's an amazing endeavor to want to paint, but when you can't paint, it's problematic. Kitchen tool seller. When you are telling a room full of potential customers how safe your gadget is and simultaneously slice off the end of your finger, it's both gross and career-ending. Please forgive me if you were a client at one of these said failed endeavors. It was such a bumpy ride, but tucked inside each of these failed endeavors were clues that I was made to create. But my assignment wasn't floral arrangements or wedding experiences or paintings or cuisine. It was stringing words together through writing. Had I been successful at those other jobs, I may never have pursued my real calling. I no longer look at those things as career-defining failures. I now see them as clues pointing in a better direction, the right direction for me. You are more than you know, my friend. So much more. The Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. Though he may stumble, he will not fall, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. Psalm 37:23-24. 8. What one person sees as your liability, another might see as a wonderful asset. The other day I posted something on social media about a harsh letter I received years ago. The purpose of the post wasn't to wallow in the past, but rather to help others going through this same kind of rejection process their hurt with hope. Many women thanked me and found the post to be very helpful, hopeful, and encouraging. But one gal saw this post as proof that I wasn't walking in freedom and felt the need to challenge me. The first time I read her comment, I thought, what in the world? But then I realized it was my vulnerability she didn't like. What many saw as an asset of mine, she saw as a liability. A good question to ask myself in this situation is, while this quality is good to most, am I using it in its most mature form? This commenter didn't think a Bible teacher should display her feelings. To her, this was a sign of weakness. And to be honest, in the absence of maturity, this could absolutely be a detriment in ministry. It's not bad that I'm vulnerable, but am I displaying a mature form of my vulnerability? This is a really good thing to consider instead of just blowing off her comment. I have to remember that her opinion is not the whole truth. While it's good to consider what she said, I must make the choice not to get consumed by it. I have to keep it all in perspective. God's eyes are on me. His face is not against me. And even if others appear to be against me, I must make sure in my reaction to them that I extend grace and honor God. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Luke 6:27-28. 9. This is a short-term setback, not a permanent condition. The emotions that feel so intense today will ease up over time as long as we let them. We just have to watch how we think and talk about this rejection. If we give it the power to define us, it will haunt us long-term. But if we only allow it enough power to refine us, the hurt will give way to healing. Remember that guy I mentioned in chapter 7 who I was convinced was my future husband? When he broke up with me, the pain was so intense that for months I would find myself grabbing my chest, wondering if I was having a heart attack. I replayed and relived our breakup hundreds of times, and life felt sort of stopped for me that tear-filled night. That rejection tried to take up permanent residence in my heart with the statement, "I am never going to get over this." Months later, I was challenged to stop saying those words and stop believing this was a permanent condition forever defining my life. I took that challenge seriously and got rid of every reminder of him. Reminders of him were triggers for me. I took down all his pictures from my room. I threw away his love letters and cards, and I gave away a necklace he'd given me. There was no social media back then, but in today's terms, that would have meant unfollowing him. That may seem extreme, but I had to have a complete break if I was going to completely heal. Slowly my emotions stopped feeling controlled by that heartbreak. Eventually, I got to the place where I learned from my mistakes in that relationship and moved on as a refined person. Then other relationships could breathe life back into the wounded and wilted place of my heart. Though it felt so permanent at the time, in the scope of my life, I can now see it was truly just a short-term setback from which the Lord delivered me. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. Psalm 34:17. 10. Don't let this heartbreak destroy you. Let this breaking actually be the making of you. Let God use it in good ways to make you stronger and take you farther. There's a line from the prayer that Art's dad prayed over us at our wedding that I think of quite often. Lord, give them enough hurts to keep them human and enough failures to keep their hands clenched tightly in yours. There were many other lines of blessing in the prayer, but this part made me tilt my head, heavy with about 52 pounds of sprayed-up curls and a homemade veil. Praying for hurts and failures in a wedding ceremony? My face flushed at the realization I'd forgotten to cross that part out. I'd seen the prayer beforehand. It was all typed out. But in the rush of everything, I'd forgotten. And now, we had essentially asked God for heartbreak at our wedding. Awesome. But Art's dad is a wise man. And I'm thankful he didn't take it upon himself to strike that part. I couldn't have understood the prayer on that day full of white tulle, giddy whispers of love, and my 3-year-old singing happy birthday during the lighting of the unity candle. But as life has unfolded, I now very much understand the beauty of those lines. Our life could have been very self-focused. Our marriage, our home, our kids, our plans, our life. But God wanted so much more from us. He didn't bring us together simply to build a life that would make us happy. He brought us together to be partners in the purpose he assigned. Our own strength would not have prepared us for kingdom assignments. It would have crippled us. The breaking of us has actually been the making of us, the God-strengthened us he could use. Heartbreak is a part of life. It's certainly been a part of different seasons of my marriage. And though every single hurt seemed like an exposure of weakness in our relationship, it actually brought out a strength we couldn't have gotten any other way. And for those of you whose marriage didn't remain standing under the weight of life, please don't get stuck thinking these truths are only for couples. Do not let the heartbreak you have experienced be wasted. God is still with you. His promises still stand. Soak in his truths and let them seep into the deepest places of your heart rubbed raw with uncertainty. Married or not, don't let what breaks your heart destroy your life. Hold fast to Jesus and remember, this breaking of you will be the making of you, a new you, a stronger you, strengthened not with the pride of perfection, but with the sweet grace of one who knows an intimate closeness with her Lord. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Psalm 34:18. Using the original language for this verse, you could read it like this. The Lord draws near to the one who has had her heart shattered and delivers her from exposed grief to victory. He draws you near despite the sharp evidence of your grieving heart, the anger, the deep disappointment and disillusionment, the questions of why you and why now, the comparisons that make you feel as though God loves other people more. How could he let this happen? The cussing and banging your fist on the steering wheel, the shame and anguish, all of these are shards of being shattered. God isn't afraid of your sharp edges that may seem quite risky to others. He doesn't pull back. He pulls you close. His love and grace covers your exposed grief and step by step leads you to a new place of victory, a sweet place your soul is so glad to be in, though you never would have chosen the hard path on your own. Back to Ashley at the restaurant, letting the past school rejection taunt her. Remember, what consumes us controls us. As I helped her process her fears through the filter of truth, courage emerged that no matter what, good or bad, she could trust God. And please understand, I didn't preach a sermon to her. It only took a few reminders of truth to see more clearly. Lies flee in the presence of truth. Finally, she clicked open the email revealing her grades. Not only did she pass, she was on the dean's list. I was so thankful that day. Hers were tears of joy. But I'm also well aware that in the tomorrows that come, things could be different. Rejections, big and small, just seem to ebb and flow in and out of life. Troubles will probably still find us. But the Lord doesn't just deliver us from some of our troubles. Psalm 34:19 through 20 tells us he delivers us from them all. The righteous person may have many troubles, but the Lord delivers him from them all. He protects all his bones. Not one of them will be broken. And I'll give that truth a big, huge amen. Chapter 12. The enemy's plan against you. I'm not a fan of lions, not at all, because they aren't picky with their food choices. Whether you're a gazelle that got separated from your herd or a tourist crazy enough to sleep in a tent where lions roam, they'll think you look amazing. And it really makes no difference to them if you're covered in animal fur or a Gap t-shirt. They will stalk you if they're hungry. These creatures have woven into their DNA an animal instinct that's nearly impossible to override. You can try to train them. You can try to domesticate them, and for a while you might even be able to snuggle them like a pet. But coursing underneath their tamed appearance is the instinct of a wild, wild beast. A beast I never thought I'd encounter face to face. But I was wrong. When my family and I decided we wanted to go back to the continent where my two sons were born and do missions work, a splinter of fear shot through my heart. But then I scolded myself for being so stereotypical. White girl in America thinks of Africa and instantly sees huts and lions. Shame on me. I tossed my fear aside as I packed a ridiculous amount of clothes and hair products to head to the mission field. We were off to save the world, or at least to feed some beautiful kids in an orphanage tucked at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. We loved and we learned and we left with a lump of emotion in our throats. And then we made good on the promise to our family that we'd go on an African picture-taking safari our last two nights there. We pulled up to our accommodations, and I swallowed hard, partly because the dust from the drive covered every inch of me and coated my throat with the unpleasant feeling I'd been snacking on sand, but also because I saw tents. For real. They were fabric-sided and triangular-shaped with zipper closures for front doors. In the spirit of full disclosure, let me add that they were sitting on top of wooden platforms and each had a bed and a potty inside. This was a good thing considering there was a large sign strongly encouraging us not to ever leave our tents after dark for any reason. An indoor potty was a total bonus for my 40-year-old bladder that acts like a newborn in its refusal to sleep through the night. It's a situation I share with you because by this time in the book, I totally consider you a friend. And friends share this kind of stuff. But back to the sign about not leaving your tent after dark, ever. There was another small detail on this sign you should know about. The instruction not to keep any food in the tent. We're talking not a cracker or even the 10 little M&Ms that sit at the bottom of your purse in case of a really desperate day. I quickly discerned the opposition to us having snacks wasn't some sort of effort to help us manage our weight. It was because the lions would smell the food and come after it, and in the process, come after us. Call me loopy, but I was suddenly no longer in the mood to be in a tent in Africa with snack-crazy lions nearby. My people, on the other hand, find situations like this thrilling. They jump off rock quarries, swim with sharks, and wish they could be tornado chasers. I much prefer to sit in a quiet corner reading books and eating emergency M&Ms for a throw. To say I was fretting nightfall is quite an understatement. Art announced he was going to bed and just like that drifted into a cozy little dream. Meanwhile, I had a death grip on the top of the bed sheet and could hear my heart drumming against the lumpy mattress. I wanted to take a sleeping pill, but when I found the empty wrapper, it confirmed a terrible thing. Art had already taken one. That meant I was the only one sober enough to ward the lions away should they venture into camp, albeit armed with nothing but sheer terror and absolute anxiety. The guides had assured us the lions wouldn't come. They lied. Right when I was flirting with the edges of sleep, a creature brushed the length of my tent and, wait for it, roared. Think of the sound that monster under your bed from your childhood imagination would undoubtedly make whenever he jumped out to get you. Now magnify that by about 10 times, African animal style. And then the lion moaned and whined as he brushed the tent again, this time inches from my head. Art, the calm one who fixes stuff like this, had been rendered useless by his night-night pill. I was infuriated the sign hadn't instructed all husbands against taking sleeping medicine. I held my body perfectly still, barely letting air in and out of my lungs. But my mind wouldn't cooperate. It fired off one imagined scene after another of all the worst scenarios and horrific outcomes that could possibly come of this rather unfortunate situation. Though I never stepped outside the tent or touched a beast of any sort, I suffered a brutal attack of the mind. I wrestled that lion and lost because I let him get the best of my thoughts. I'm not writing about this scenario so that you'll be better prepared if you're ever on safari staying in a tent. You don't have to go to Africa to get stalked by a lion. There's a roaring lion waiting just around every next thought you think. And make no mistake, there's no taming him. He's a defeated foe who has already suffered a fatal blow. But before he falls, he'll try to make a few last kills. With everything he's got left, he's coming after your mind. This injured lion is the most vicious of all. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. 1 Peter 5:8. He's not just looking to distract you or tempt you or pull you slightly off course. He's looking to devour you. But we must remember something crucial. The devil is vicious, but he's not victorious. And you, my friend, have everything you need to defeat him. You don't have to lie there shaking in your bed with a death grip on the covers, feeling powerless and deathly afraid. The devil is powerful, but he's also predictable. We are told in 1 John 2:16 the exact three ways he's going to come after us. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. He's coming after me today by making me want to get my needs met outside the will of God. He will dangle scenarios in front of me that evoke feelings that tempt me to crave, lust, and boast. Crave. I feel empty. Whenever I feel lonely or less than, I think I can fill my emptiness with temporary physical pleasures. The things I consume soon consume my thoughts. What started as a little thing has become something of which I can't ever quite get enough. Lust. I feel deprived. When my eyes see the shiny, sexy, and slick things others have, I can become laser-focused that I need something to make my life more shiny. Justifications come easy. Rationalizations numb my conscience. Be it a possession, person, or position, I'm lured by the intoxicating notion that I can sneak outside the will of God to get what I want, and it's no big deal. Boast. I feel rejected. Do I ever post something on social media to try and make myself feel better or more accepted? The likes and comments ward off the stings of rejection, but at what cost? Is it just a masked form of boasting when I pick up the picture that makes my life appear a little more polished than it actually is? The devil wants me to fill my emptiness with an unhealthy dependence on the acceptance of others. Because then he can get me so focused on the shallow opinions of others, I get completely distracted from deepening my relationship with Christ. And in the process, is my mask boasting pulling others into the crazy comparison traps that lures them away from Christ as well? It's all such an unhealthy cycle that's never satisfying. And again, I'm not against social media, but we do have to be so careful how we use it. Is it to bless others with encouragement and love, or are we really just boasting on ourselves and feeding others unhealthy comparisons to us? One quick hop on social media and you'll see how careful we must be not to play right into the devil's schemes. According to a 2015 study I conducted in partnership with Barna Group, women ages 18 and older in the United States go to social media looking to connect and feel better about themselves, but only 14% walk away feeling encouraged. That's a whopping 86% who may be going about their day feeling emptier and more deprived than before. Nearly half of women report feeling lonely at least occasionally after spending time on social media. 62% of millennials say they feel lonely at least occasionally, with 1 in 10 saying they usually do. It's also interesting to me that 6 out of 10 women say they feel like they want to change something about their lives at least occasionally after looking at social media. More than 78% of millennials feel that way at least occasionally, with 21% saying they usually do. I understand it's hard to put a face to a statistic. So I decided to ask my Facebook friends how they would describe their experiences with social media to see if it lined up with the research. And it did. Donna N. said, "I'm connected to so many, yet I feel lonelier. Isn't anyone out there having a bad day too? Life feels less honest somehow." Kelly S. said, "I can't help but compare myself to others' lives and feel like I don't measure up. People are only posting the positive stuff, so it's easy to look at it and feel like they don't have their own problems." Shelby B. said, "I feel lonely and left out. It's not right when I see women from my church posting pictures of themselves out having a good time, and I have not been invited. I feel lonely all the time, as I do try to make friends, but everyone seems so disconnected. If I could just have one close friend, it would mean so much to me." My heart aches when I read these brutally honest confessions. Again, I'm not against social media being used in healthy ways. But we sure do need to be honest with ourselves. Is it helping us fight the lion, or is it actually feeding it? And when I said that the devil is predictable, he totally is. These are the same three ways he tempted Jesus in Matthew 4, 1 through 11. After Jesus had fasted for 40 days, the devil placed stones in front of him, knowing Jesus could easily turn them into bread, bread that could fill his emptiness. Jesus knew what empty felt like. The devil also showed him worldly wealth and splendor. Jesus had emerged from a stable and hardly progressed past the basics of belongings. Having lived in perfection with memories of heaven, he found that every one of his earthly realities fell short. Jesus knew what being deprived felt like. The devil also reminded Jesus of an untapped power source that would have surely silenced the skeptics and corrected the critics. Those who shunned him and shamed him would suddenly bow down before him. Can you imagine the restraint it surely took not to throw himself down and in a sweep of angelic majesty be elevated and worshipped by heavenly beings? Jesus knew what being rejected felt like. Jesus knew. He knew the feelings. He knew the struggles. And in an earth-shattering moment, Jesus exposed the way of escape for us. He matched every feeling, the emptiness, the deprivation, and the rejection, with truths straight from God's word. Lies flee in the presence of truth. And the devil turns powerless when our minds turn to our all-powerful God. Here's where I become quite fascinated. Jesus had access to thousands of scriptures from the Old Testament. He knew them. He could have used any of them. But he chose three specific ones. I decided I want these three to be at the top of my mind. I want a promise for my problem of feeling empty. Man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Deuteronomy 8:3. My soul was hand-designed to be richly satisfied in deep places by the word of God. When I go without the nourishment of truth, I will crave filling my spiritual hunger with temporary physical pleasures, thinking they will somehow treat the loneliness inside. These physical pleasures can't fill me, but they can numb me. Numb souls are never growing souls. They wake up one day feeling so very distant from God and wondering how in the world they got there. Since Satan's goal is to separate us from the Lord, this is exactly where he wants us to stay. But the minute we turn to his word is the minute the gap between us and God is closed. He is always near. His word is full and fully able to reach those deep places inside us, desperate for truth. I want a promise for my problem of feeling deprived. Fear the Lord your God. Serve him only and take your oaths in his name. Deuteronomy 6:13. Another version of this verse says, worship him, your true God, and serve him. When we worship God, we reverence Him above all else. A great question to ask, is my attention being held by something sacred or something secret? What is holding my attention the most is what I'm truly worshiping. Sacred worship is all about God. Secret worship is all about something in this world that seems so attractive on the outside, but will devour you on the inside. Pornography, sex outside of marriage, trading your character to claw your way to a position of power, fueling your sense of worth with your child's successes, and spending outside of your means to constantly dress your life in the next new thing. All things we do to counteract feelings of being left out of and not invited to the good things God has given others. These are just some of the ways lust sneaks in and wreaks havoc. Two words that characterize misplaced worship or lust are secret excess. God says if we will direct our worship to Him, He will give us strength to turn from the mistakes of yesterday and provide portions for our needs of today. Whom have I in heaven but You? And earth has nothing I desire besides You. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Psalm 73:25-26. And I certainly want to promise for my problem of feeling rejected. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. Deuteronomy 6:16. At first glance, I didn't understand why God chose Deuteronomy 6:16 to combat rejection. And it almost makes me doubt this third part has anything to do with it. But then it stirs my heart so wonderfully when I tuck it back in the context of the other verses around it. Verses 13 through 15 remind us, "Fear the Lord your God, serve Him only, and take your oaths in His name. Do not follow other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. For the Lord your God, who is among you, is a jealous God." He's jealous for you. He is jealous for me. The fullness of His love and lavish acceptance is the only match for the rejections we will experience. And He absolutely doesn't want us making other relationships the false gods of our worship. As we seek love and acceptance, God doesn't want us to test Him. He wants us to trust Him. When He says that we are holy and dearly loved children, we must trust that this is true. Studying these three promises proclaimed by Jesus has captured my heart. When I remember the promises of God, I tap into the power of God. God's promises are always a perfect match for our problems. And our problem instigator, the devil, the lion, is no match for God's promises. Promises don't tame the lion. They shame the lion back to hell. They shut his mouth, turn his roar into a whimper, and make him run timid when the Bible-toting, scripture-memorizing girl in the Gap t-shirt looks his way. She is terrifyingly brave and so very beautiful. That's you. That's me. We just have to remember that where we pay attention matters more than we know. Our minds and hearts are like dry sponges. What we focus on is what will soak in and saturate us. If it is something foolish, we will make foolish decisions. If it is wise, we will make wise decisions. Satan knows this, so he constantly puts things in front of us to try and grab our attention. Remember, like a lion is drawn to a food source, Satan rushes in where he smells emptiness, deprivation, and rejection. If we pay attention to foolish things and things that fuel foolishness in us, we will bankrupt our perspective. And we will be more likely to fall prey to Satan's schemes. Satan's schemes are well-thought-through plans specifically targeted at our particular weaknesses to do three things: to increase our desire for something outside the will of God, to make us think giving into a weakness is no big deal, to minimize our ability to think through the consequences of falling to this temptation. Can I take your hand right now and look you straight in the eyes with a pleading statement? You are more susceptible to Satan's schemes when you are feeling rejected. Emotional pain will scream for relief. And it's so easy to start justifying thoughts and actions outside God's will. That's why it's crucial to watch what is influencing me and feeding my thoughts. A good question to ask myself is, where am I paying my attention? Specifically, what am I paying attention to first thing in the morning? And what am I paying attention to right before I go to sleep? If I want God to be my focus, I must give Him my first thoughts. And if I want my mind to be at peace when I sleep, I must keep my thoughts fixed on His promises at night, whether I'm in a tent on the African plain or not. Obviously, I don't have lions regularly brush by my house, but I don't want to forget that night in the tent when I experienced the reality of the prowl, the roar, the danger. It was frightening. But the lion's power over me stopped the minute the guards showed up with the tranquilizer guns. One shot, and the lion fell. Truth is the perfect tranquilizer. The enemy's power is rendered powerless in the presence of God's promises. Remember this. Receive this. Use this. Practice this. Live this. Chapter 13. Miracles in the Mess. I ran my hand over the large rock and closed my eyes. What an incredible moment it was for me to stand where Jesus once stood. I opened my Bible and let the full reality of all He faced when He stood in the same place fall fresh on me. I wanted to read the scriptures leading up to this moment when He sat on Mount Arbel and prayed and watched the disciples just before He walked on water. I cautioned myself to note the uncommon sentences. Too many times I highlight verses telling of Jesus' miracles, but skim right past those telling of deeply human realities. In Mark 5, for example, we see Jesus interacting with a woman desperate to be healed from her bleeding disorder. He frees her from her suffering and gives her peace. We also find Him healing the young daughter of a synagogue ruler. Miracles. But then there's verse 40. They laughed at Him. In Mark 6, we find Jesus sending out the 12 disciples, and as they preached, they drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. Verse 13. Miracles. But we also find verse 3. And they took offense at Him. We see Him having great compassion on the people who followed Him in the feeding of the 5,000. They all ate and were satisfied by 5 loaves and 2 fish. Miracle. But we also see that Jesus and His disciples were physically depleted because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat. Verse 31. Messy realities in the midst of the miracles. And isn't it so like us to miss this about Jesus' everyday life? We hyper-focus on the lines of Scripture containing the miracles, and we miss the details of the mess. People laughed at Jesus. People rejected Jesus. People misunderstood Jesus. We know this in theory, but as I sat on that rock that day, I suddenly realized what an everyday reality this was for Him. And because this was a reality for Him, He is the perfect one to turn to when rejection is a reality for us. He understands. He teaches us from that tender place of knowing this pain personally. And best of all, He chose to do His miracles in the midst of messy realities. Remember this. Don't get so consumed by and focused on the mess, the feelings of rejection, hurt, and disillusionment, that you miss the miracle. That's the very thing that happened to the disciples right after the feeding of the 5,000. They got in a boat and quickly found themselves in rough waters, tossed by strong winds. They strained at the oars as the realities of life beat against them. This storm was a terrifying mess for them. The waves weren't just ebbing, cresting, and crashing like you've probably seen if you've ever been in rough waters. These waves were bubbling up and exploding all around them in unpredictable ways. Think what it looks like when you place a straw in a glass of water and blow with great force. They couldn't brace themselves or their boat. They were completely helpless. Jesus was on the mountainside praying. And from this spot, He could see the middle of the lake. Mark 6:47 through 48 says, "Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars, because the wind was against them. Jesus saw them. He went down to them, and they missed the miracle in the midst of the mess. The same miracle worker they had watched multiply the fish and loaves was now walking on the water near them, and they thought he was a ghost. They cried out, because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, 'Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid.' Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened." Verses 49 through 52. The word hardened, as it used here, means unresponsive, completely lacking sensitivity or spiritual perception. How can this be? How could it possibly be that the disciples' hearts were lacking sensitivity and spiritual perception? They had been with Jesus. The fullness of God had breathed on them, walked with them, served alongside them, and worked miracles in the midst of them. I can tell you how. They had witnessed expressions of God, but they had turned those expressions into personal experiences. The NASB translation of verse 52 hints at this. "For they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened." The Greek word for insight here is suniemi, which means to put facts together to arrive at an understanding complete with life applications. The disciples had not done that with the miracle of the loaves and fishes. In other words, they had seen a lot. They had heard a lot. But they had not personally applied what they'd seen and heard. Their hearts were not tender to the reality of Jesus. Their hearts were hardened. Access without application will not equal transformation. How does this relate to us? We can go to Bible study and amen every point made, but if we don't apply it to our lives, we won't be changed. And I'll even take it a step further and say that if we've been exposed to a teaching that we know we need to implement and we don't make any changes, that's a clue that the hardening of that part of our heart is in process. Inspiration and information without personal application will never amount to transformation. A rock song can inspire us. The nightly news can inform us. But it is only by applying the truth of God to our lives that we can be transformed in the direction of God's best for us. Romans 12:2 reminds us to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. It's that shift in thinking that we've been talking about, operating out of fullness and living loved despite whatever circumstances may be surrounding us. The disciples were surely inspired by Jesus' miracle, and they were certainly informed by his teaching. But because they had not personally applied what they learned, they weren't transformed. Only when we seek to apply his revelations to our situations will we experience transformation. Transformation helps us more clearly see Jesus. And when we more clearly see him, we can more clearly see the miracle in our mess, the good in our difficulty, the redemption in rejection. How tragic that Jesus miraculously walked on water to come save his disciples in the middle of the mess of the storm, and they didn't recognize him. They were close to him, but unaware of his presence. They could hear him, but could not grasp his promises. And they surely needed him, but did not take hold of his provision. And they were terrified. Please, please, please don't miss this. Any place where we have hardened our hearts or refused to let truth touch and transform that part of us, there will be confusion. Just like the disciples seeing Jesus walking toward them and thinking he was a ghost. What did they do in the midst of this confusion? They cried out in fear instead of calling out to their Lord in faith. They were terrified. Why? Let's look at that word terrified as it is used in these scriptures. It's terasso, which means to set in motion what needs to remain still. Can we all just sit down and soak in this little gem for half a minute? Or actually,